What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
In very exciting news, we are playing music made by the band Cordoba.
Hey, thanks so much, man. We really appreciate the tunes.
Yeah, they're a radical band from Chicago. Hello, and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper, and I'm joined by...
Gabriel Pacheco here.
And we are the Katie Halper Show, and you can find us on iTunes, where you can rate and review us. You can find us on SoundCloud. You can find us on Twitter. I'm KT Helps. That's letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. Gabe is...
Gabe_Pacheco.
Yes. And make sure you join our Patreon at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow, where you will find... bonus episodes and extended interviews, and it just makes your life a lot better.
Yeah, if you're willing to subscribe to other things that are less woke than this.
Then what are you doing with your life?
Yeah, come on. Get with the program.
Get with the program, yeah. And you'll get bonus episodes, you get extended interviews, you get a bonus interview with Glenn Greenwald. I spoke to David Sirota, the man who made Beto basically come at us somewhat supportive of the Green New Deal.
What did Beto say that he was, agrees with the concept.
Yeah, he's supportive of the idea of it, which, I mean, it's kind of sad that that's what, where people are. Also, Elizabeth Warren spoke and like barely mentioned, she didn't mention Medicare for All and was asked about it and gave some really vague answers. So we got to have like David Sirota who
I'm happy to help you flirt with the notion of perhaps maybe coming up with a study to think about the option of the Medicare
Green,
for All.
I'm Medicare for All curious.
That's right.
Right. And Green New Deal curious.
Yeah, Green New Deal flexible.
Yeah, exactly. Flexual. Oh my God, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I don't know if you saw this, but there's a leaked video of her dancing.
A 30-second video clip widely shared on Twitter, showing New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dancing on a rooftop.
And everyone is going crazy. The Republicans hate her. But I think that they actually have big crushes on her, the male Republicans.
How could they not?
I know.
She's the only good politician.
Yeah. Well, Ro Khanna also.
Yeah.
Also a great one. Yeah, this video of her was quote-unquote leaked.
But I think there should be mandatory dance videos. Every senator or congressperson has to make a dance video.
To even get considered for the election. To
it's
get on the ballot.
It's got
to
be on like the .gov websites.
Right. I agree.
I need to know how you dance.
Right. Well, it's funny because she is so videogenic and photogenic and attractive that it look. I mean, I would like pay to get that kind of dance music video.
You would get a PR team to help you make that dance video.
Right? I feel like, you know what she's like? She's like our Trump, but not a bad person.
Yeah.
In that nothing sticks to her. She's so good at media that when like Republicans attack her, she has the best zingers back to them.
Yeah, I mean, she just uses common sense and she doesn't say things like, well, I'll flirt with the idea of perhaps...
Right.
acknowledging the concept of this idea possibly working. Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter.
Right. You know, once she got busted, quote unquote busted, if only we all had those embarrassing videos leaked where we look really good. She made another little video on social media where she's like going into her office and they're playing the song War. Good God, yeah, what is it good for? Absolutely nothing. And she's lip syncing and then goes into the room. And everything she does, she just looks cool.
Yes.
And the reason I think she's Trump-like is because none of the attacks on her stick.
That's right.
I mean, it's like, imagine, I'm saying this in a complimentary way, though, not a diss. She's like the inverse of, the equal and opposite of Trump.
Well, people are just going to steal that. That's going to be the soundbite, though, Katie.
Yeah.
AOC is our Trump.
Yeah.
You said it here first. You heard it here first.
Yeah. Yeah, in the best way. So on today's episode, we speak to David Parsons, who is an historian and wrote the book Dangerous Grounds. Dangerous Grounds, Anti-War Coffeehouses and Military Dissent in the Vietnam Era. And it's about coffeehouses and how they were hubs of organizing. And David shatters a lot of really dangerous myths.
I love coffee houses.
Me too.
I love coffee. Like a bean to bar coffee, like a third wave coffee shop.
Ooh, I like that.
Like a Verve or a Grumpy. I like it where there's a barista who's maybe done some foam art competitions.
Oh, yeah. I've never had that. I'd love to have
that. You're more of a second wave coffee type
gal. I guess so, yeah.
You like that Starbucks.
Yeah, that venti. Kind of the Seattle scene.
Okay.
I like my Gloria Steinem cups.
Yeah,
no, I don't. But that
so
be...
he's talking about coffee shops. What's so the other
coffee shops in the Vietnam War?
What the Vietnam, dude? Vietnam. I'm too young for it, but I loved the movies.
Contrary to popular belief, guys, Gabe is not a Vietnam War vet.
Yeah, Apocalypse Now though, fantastic film.
Yeah.
Yep.
I saw that one.
That's Platoon.
Don't think I saw that.
Dead Presidents.
Didn't see that.
Full Metal Jacket.
Didn't see that.
Okay.
Platoon is the one where in the very good movie Naked Gun, that slapstick comedy.
Yeah.
They are on a date, the couple, the main couple, and they do this romantic montage and they leave a movie theater and they're laughing and the camera pans back and they have just exited a movie theater playing Platoon.
Wow.
So that's my introduction to that
great
movie.
Great first date film.
Yeah.
Really yeah. Good. Interesting.
Yeah. You know what's interesting also, Gabe, is that my mom, and as you know, because we've spoken to her, my mom's a novelist, and she wrote a book called When You Come Home, which is about three generations of war, and World War II, the Vietnam War, and Gulf War One, not two, just those were not good wars. Hot take, bad wars.
Everyone and which one was the only righteous war? The Gulf War? Protecting the tiny...
The Kuwaitis?
Yes.
Operation Help Kuwait. I would say World War II was the only good one out of those three. Probably the only good one ever in American history, I think.
Because it boosted our economy so much?
Well, that and we were on the right side.
Yeah.
And in terms of
but it was a coin toss.
Yeah.
If you look at the history of the of Alan Dulles and the OSS and you know our financial interests,
right?
Could have gone either way.
So we're really glad it went this way.
Sure.
Defeating Nazism was a good thing.
Yeah, that's correct.
So we have a great chat with David and then with Nora Eisenberg, my mother, novelist and also a journalist. And David and my mom both talk about the first Gulf War. My mom a little bit more than David.
Sure.
In the wake of the death of George Herbert Walker Bush, there hasn't been that much coverage of the first Gulf War. Some talk of AIDS, which is good. I mean... That's bad. The talking of it is good.
Yeah.
Iran, the war on drugs.
Panama,
that was the thing. Panama,
being
yeah.
a director of the CIA.
CIA, yes. Right. Bad thing. Groping women also.
Yes.
Yeah.
Giving birth to Jeb and George.
Right. Those were crimes against humanity. Continuing the progeny of Barbara Bush.
Yes.
Not a good thing. So, yeah. So, that's an interesting chat. And, yeah, I think you'll enjoy it a lot. We are so excited to finally be talking to David Parsons, who you may know him from his great podcast called Nostalgia Trap, The Nostalgia Trap. And
I'm subscribed on iTunes.
There you go.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah. We love to hear that.
Yeah. And also you guys should subscribe to his Patreon, to the Patreon for Nostalgia Trap. The Nostalgia Trap. You know, you could do a little boat, like do a combo, like matching funds. Like you donate to David's, you donate to ours.
Yeah.
But instead of matching funds, you just feel happy.
I feel like there's an army of people out there that are giving $5 a month to various podcasts, and we should be on that roster for sure.
Yes, yeah. So let's talk about your book, which is really excellent, and people should definitely get it. Purchase it, and it's Dangerous Grounds, Anti-War Coffeehouses and Military Dissent in the Vietnam Era. Get it? Get the pun, everyone? Dangerous Grounds.
Grounds, yeah.
Yeah, that was a good pun in there. I liked it.
I had other ones, but that's the one that made the cut.
Yeah, I really liked it. So you should read that, and also you can read a great piece that he wrote at the New York Times if you want kind of like a preview of it as you order it. And that piece is called How Coffee Houses Fueled the Vietnam Peace Movement. So tell people about your book, your research, and how it applies to today.
Oh, okay.
Very specific questions, right?
Yeah. So I was looking for, and this kind of goes along with the kind of biographical element of it. When I was at the CUNY Graduate Center starting the PhD program in history, it was a long, long time ago. It was in 2004. And in 2004, there was a presidential election. John Kerry ran and challenged George W. Bush. And there was like the Vietnam War was in that election, if you remember. And there's like, you know, the Swift boat thing. Yeah, exactly. John Kerry made the like super embarrassing entrance at the Democratic National Convention to accept the nomination. And like he came out and saluted and said, "I'm John Kerry and I'm reporting for duty."
"I'm John Kerry and I'm reporting for duty."
And it was just the biggest cringe. And I think that's part, you know, some of that kind of explains a little bit of why the Democrats always lose.
For our younger listeners, could you just tell people what swift voting is?
"I served with John Kerry.
I served with John Kerry.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury.
John Kerry lied to get his Bronze Star. I know. I was there. I saw what happened."
Okay, so swift voting was the phenomenon of a number of GOP operatives who were who essentially came forward with stories that they had served with John Kerry in Vietnam, and that he served with less than honor, and that he was actually exaggerating his service, that he wasn't as injured as he alleged that he was injured. And they kind of succeeded in creating this like doubt about John Kerry's service and made him look like he was maybe lying about it, even though none of their accusations or charges turned out to be to carry any weight at all.
Right, be true at all.
Yeah, it was basically just like a propaganda lie. But it worked, and what was crazy about it is George W. Bush ended up looking like the military hero, even though he had like kind of skirted out of military service by getting a cushy job in the Air National Guard in Arkansas. So that's swift voting, and like I think that's become a term in politics since 2004. Swift voting is like any effort to kind of like, I don't know, undermine the kind of veracity of the claims of a candidate. To go back to like John Kerry, the kind of legacy of the Vietnam War was in the news, and I saw that as poisoning the politics. Still, I thought it was wrong for the mainstream media to just kind of like buy this swift boat story, but also like the George W. Bush administration used military men and women as props in their imperial war in the Middle East, and I felt like the Vietnam War was tied up with that, and that the memory of the Vietnam War in particular, you know, there was all this kind of like talk that even since like the first Gulf War under George H.W. Bush was fought with like the conscious idea that they had to like get over the Vietnam legacy, right? And so I knew that the Vietnam War was
Vietnam kind of, syndrome, right?
Yeah, is that what exactly. It was? Yeah. The Vietnam syndrome was the idea that Americans would not support war, and certainly wouldn't support kind of open-ended missions like what happened in Vietnam. And so there was this kind of like idea that the whole you know horrific history of the Vietnam War had been papered over and distorted. And was being actively used by the Bush administration to kind of support their wars. So that's where I kind of began thinking about, well, the military men and women, and who are they, and were they really as supportive of the war, and are they really these like kind of like patriotic, blank patriotic heroes that they're being portrayed as, or is there something a little more going on? And I think that John Kerry you know, was in the news at the time because he was the presidential candidate, but people knew, and you saw clips of him in the VVAW, which is Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Right.
And he spoke, you know, he spoke in the Senate in 1971 very eloquently to like a standing ovation from all these veterans.
Each day to facilitate the process by which the United States washes her hands of Vietnam, someone has to give up his life so that the United States doesn't have to admit something that the entire world already knows. So that we cannot say that we've made a mistake. Someone has to die so that President Nixon won't be, and these are his words, the first president to lose a war. And we are asking Americans to think about that. Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?
And it, like, that story made me think, well, there are a whole lot of military men and women from the Vietnam era that are not down with the war. And who, where are they? Where are their voices anywhere in any of this? So that kind of made me go down the rabbit hole. And I ended up finding a documentary by a filmmaker named David Zeiger, who was a participant in the GI movement in the Vietnam War. He made a documentary in 2005 called Sir, No Sir. It's a great it's one of those like we talked about, like that, like kind of like little like progressive burst of like lefty documentaries in the in the 2000s during the Bush era. It was one of those, but it was one of the better ones because it told us a history, like this history of the GI movement, which was, you know, that there were tens of thousands of GIs in the Army, mostly in the Army, but in other branches of the armed forces too, that not only like were against the war, but actively opposed the war.
Right.
And finding that documentary was what sent me down to explore a little more of what that movement looked like. And there's a quick clip in the middle of that film of a coffee house in Texas called the Oleo Strut.
With more and more soldiers turning against the war, a handful of peace activists opened the first of what would become a network of dozens of anti-war GI coffee houses located in the towns that hover near military bases. The dusty Texas town of Killeen, just outside Fort Hood, which housed over 20,000 troops, became home of a GI coffee house known as the Oleo Strut.
And it's in Killeen, Texas, outside of Fort Hood. And that made me think that, you know, what are these coffee houses? What are they about? They were coffee houses that were built by anti-war civilians and active duty GIs who built coffee houses to basically create conversations between the anti-war movement and the larger anti-war movement and military men and women that were in the Army and in the military. So those coffee houses kind of like I was lucky. I found a story that no one had heard of. And what I discovered is that there were like dozens of these coffee houses. They played an instrumental role in some of the like biggest moments of resistance and rebellion during the Vietnam War era in the military. And they were kind of like this lost piece of the story. And to me, like, you know, we can keep talking about them, but like the main thing I'd want to say about them is that the coffee houses are like the physical evidence that story that we're told about the Vietnam War and like particularly the anti-war movement hating American soldiers and disrespecting American soldiers and that critique of the war was like spitting in an American soldier's faces. All that mythology is destroyed by the existence of the coffee houses and the GI movement, which shows you that, like, you know, the story is detailed and the story is dramatic. I mean, the American government and the American military were terrified of the left being in the military, and they weren't sure exactly what to do about it because they saw how popular the left was getting, particularly like underground newspapers, which were being produced by the thousands and distributed on military bases, not only in the United States, but in Vietnam, in Japan, Germany. And the underground newspapers of the Vietnam era, particularly the ones that were written and produced by and for military people, they're like, it's like an extraordinary archive. It's not just like a couple like flyers or newspapers. It's like they had printing presses. Mm. They put out volumes of this stuff. They distributed tens of thousands of copies of this literature. And you talk about like accessing the left. You know, we have the ability to kind of like, you know, download podcasts, go on Twitter, find left ideas. You can find them more easily. But during this time, you know, information was much more easily controlled by the U.S. government. And so these underground newspapers, coffee houses, these were like a lifeline to the left for people that were curious about anti-war ideas, curious about the larger left, curious about the counterculture. And so the coffee houses for me are just a way to explore kind of how the left circulates ideas and how the civilian kind of anti-war movement relates to the people that are actually fighting the wars.
Right. So what was the most surprising thing, by the way, during your research? Was there anything that really stood out that you didn't expect?
I think finding out, I mean, there are a lot of things, but I think that finding out how woke these activists were,
right.
Like they were talking about issues like gay people in the military. There are underground newspapers talking about the role of women in the military before anyone else was talking about that stuff. I feel like, you know, when I'm reading these underground newspapers from like 69, 1970, it's extraordinary to see how forward they were thinking. It's almost like, I don't know, there's this lost history of how radical the 1960s and 70s really were and how a lot of those ideas, you know, they trickled into the mainstream. We see them present today, but I don't think we understand how, I don't know, how conscientious and how diverse this movement was. People get their ideas about the 1960s and 1970s from, like, I don't know, Forrest Gump, you know,
right.
The Wonder Years.
The worst.
Yeah, and all this kind of, like, I don't know, the stuff that I was subjected to as a kid. I always thought that there was basically, you know, this weird kind of Woodstock rebellion and of hippies in the 60s and 70s, which is true. But the stuff that I'm looking at, these underground newspapers, they're produced by groups like, I don't know, the YSA, the Young Socialist Alliance, which is kind of like, I don't know, it's interesting to see how the DSA rising up today as a force in American politics, because the YSA and the SWP, the Socialist Workers Party, they were both like really involved in these movements and on college campuses. And it wasn't just about kind of like this image we have of, like, I don't know, pot smoking, free love kind of thing. They were very serious, dedicated radicals who were thinking very hard about how they could stop the war and how they could help the people that were involved in it.
And what was the relationship between these coffee houses and people serving in the military?
Well, I mean, the coffee houses existed outside of the military. They basically came to these towns. So that's another part of the story of the book, is that the U.S. military basically, you know, occupies hundreds of American towns, and those towns are, you know, essentially what you would call like a base town. I'm kind of in one right now in California, and the presence of the military is a really important part of the town. It's embedded in the culture, it's embedded in the politics, it's embedded in the economics. So like these coffee houses came to these towns and they were like, hey, we want to, you know, start a coffee house and put up a bunch of like Bob Dylan posters and, you know, even stuff like there was a coffee house that came to town and immediately put a poster of Lyndon Johnson with a toilet seat over it. So like you lifted the toilet seat and Lyndon Johnson was in it. So like they were like trolling these towns for sure. There was an element of that. So they weren't part of the U.S. military at all. They basically, you know, set up shop and said, you know, we're a coffee house that is for American soldiers. And the result was, because they were kind of, I don't know, projecting a counterculture image in towns that didn't project that at all, they created a lot of attention. And people knew about them. And so the American, you know, the GIs that were on bases, when they had time to come to town, they would come to the coffee house out of pure curiosity, because these places had they intentionally, you know, brought a kind of colorful, loud, counterculture kind of iconography to towns that were really conservative. And that's part of the story of the book, too, is the towns fought back. They were pissed. And right. The military came after them. The police came after them. Ultimately, J. Edgar Hoover is going to launch an investigation of the coffee houses. The FBI is going to raid them. They're going to send you know, all sorts of vigilantes. The story is insane. But it's one that I think indicates a little bit of, like, I don't know, the lie that we're told, that American soldiers were treated poorly by the anti-war movement, is one that's kind of, you know, complicated, I would say, by the coffee house story, because, you know, Nixon, it was Nixon, especially when he came in to office in 1969, his whole kind of ethos was very Trump-like in the sense of he was like the real American, and he was standing up for the silent majority and the real Americans and the hardworking Americans, and the soldiers were a big part of that. Like, he used soldiers and veterans and prisoners of war as these kind of icons of American suffering. And to kind of, for Nixon, you know, it was important to create that image, but the veterans that were against the war, they destroyed that image, you know, and they destroyed the idea that there was a consensus among all soldiers and that they were all against the anti-war movement. It was much more complicated than that, and the anti-war movement's relationship to American soldiers, much more complicated than any of the stories we tell.
When these coffee shops started, you know, getting established around the country in different towns, was there any coordinated effort among them, or was it sort of spontaneously people getting the same idea and then creating a network?
It ultimately was one guy who is still alive. Fred Gardner is his name. He's up in Alameda, California. He was the guy. He was a little bit older. He was a person who was
He's the Ray Kroc.
Yeah, he was, exactly. And he was writing for, like, Popular Mechanics in Manhattan, and he was really against the war and becoming more and more radical. And he felt like there needed to be a connection between the, like, rising anti-war movement and counterculture. He wanted that to be in the American military. He wanted to give soldiers, especially who were stuck on bases in the United States, a kind of place where they could go and access the anti-war movement. So he, like, tried to get support for it, ultimately, like, opened it himself. The first one in Columbia, South Carolina, the UFO Coffee House, opened that in January 1968. But it captured the attention of the movement, the organized movement, which at the time there were a couple, like, major organizations. But the one that was, I think, the biggest besides SDS, the Students for Democratic Society, the other would be a group called the National Mobilization to End the War in Vietnam, better known as the MOBES. And the MOBE people, who included people you may have heard of, like Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis, a couple of others, they approached Fred Gardner and said, we'd like to, you know, help create more coffee houses. And they launched something called the Summer of Support in 1968, which ended up putting about 7 or 8 more coffee houses across the country. And those projects got off the ground. Some were more successful than others. But there was an umbrella organization called the United States Servicemen's Fund, or USSF, which was founded by and created by people like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, a person you may have heard of who's in the GI movement called Howard Levy, who's a doctor, a dermatologist from Brooklyn.
Jewish boy.
Yeah, oh, he's great. Howard Levy is amazing. And he's still out there in Brooklyn, and he's told his story on the podcast, I think, at one point. But Howard Levy was one of the first people to go to jail for refusing service in Vietnam. He refused to be part of the propaganda efforts of the U.S. government where they were going to set up a couple dermatology clinics in South Vietnam. He said it was bullshit, and it actually violated his oath as a doctor to be part of it. He was arrested. He served 3 years in prison. But he was while he was in prison, there were people that were part of the anti-war movement visiting him in the military prison that he was held in. And they were planning the coffee house movement and other kind of actions to help grow the anti-war movement within the American military, because they saw that as kind of the key wing of the anti-war movement was getting to the people who were actually going to fight the war, getting them to refuse. And that was a major, major mission. I mean, a lot of this kind of dovetails in with what was going on with socialism at the time, because organizations like the SWP, their ethos at the time was, and you've probably heard of this strategy, they were like sending people in to go get blue-collar jobs, and so they could organize workers.
The term, salting? To salt?
Yeah, exactly. So there's like, you know, that's happened in the mining industry in West Virginia. It happened in the steel industry. And there were people, especially in the Socialist Workers' Party, who were essentially joining the American military so that they could organize against the war from within. And that phenomenon is another book, I think, that entirely like that, because the American government was totally aware of all of this. They knew, and as soon as they figured out that people were that people were engaged in socialism, they kicked them out. But there's like, you know, it took them a while to catch on. Like there's a guy, one of my favorite figures in the book is a black soldier named Joe Miles, who's drafted at the age of 21. And when he's drafted, he writes a letter to the draft board and says, I'm an out-and-out socialist, communist organizer, and if you draft me, I'm going to organize a revolution from within the American military. And they accepted him, and they brought him in anyway.
Yeah.
And within like a few weeks of being on base, he had organized meetings with like hundreds of black soldiers with fists up saying they weren't going to fight in the war, and they got rid of Joe Miles quickly after that. But the point is that the American government was caught off guard by the depth and the kind of size and range of these anti-war activities by the soldiers that were part of their military.
I got a good idea for the name of that book, Salt of the Earth.
Beautiful. I've never heard that before. It rings with something, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have a question. How does this tie in to the military today, mm-hmm. and so any partnerships or connections that, you know, left-leaning people such as ourselves that have I don't ever play with guns.
Yeah,
and I'm very, very difficult to organize into anything.
Yeah.
But when you have a highly structured institutions like the military, like what's going on there, you know, around socialism or just being a progressive? Because my impression of people in the military is that it's so much easier. The default is a more conservative mindset.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I'm currently, I actually teach history courses on a military base here in this town, and that's the first time I've done that over the course of the last few semesters. And I mean, I think that's right. I also think that there's a pretty wide range of politics within the American military, and things have changed a lot in the years since. I think the main thing is that the draft is gone, and they've kind of, you know, they've hidden military service and turned it into something else, and that something else is you know, essentially a working class job, and so the result of that in terms of socialism in the American military, God, I wish we had more of that, and I wish we had more of the, like, I don't know, physical institutions where the left can be found, because, you know, that's part of it too, is that we don't need the coffee house culture. Is kind of gone, you know, in the years since. I mean, it's Starbucks. It's kind of, and not only that, but you think about, like, I just saw this like commercial for like what, like Capital One has these banking cafes now.
I've seen one of those in Manhattan.
Yeah. And so you're like, you're and they're like, come in and like hang out and talk about, like, you know, fixed rate mortgages and stuff like that. And you're like, what the fuck is this? Because like coffee house, when you said like the words like, oh, the coffee house crowd in the 60s or 70s, people knew what you were talking about. Like left wingers that like drink coffee, hang out in these places, probably smoke weed, and like talk about left wing shit. And like that culture being gone, I think is dramatic. And in terms of the military, I mean, there have been coffee house projects. I think there are still a few, including one called Under the Hood Cafe, which I think closed, but it was open for many, many years throughout the kind of Bush years and everything like that. I think that, you know, we're at a point now where, you know, we've been at war in Afghanistan for 17 years, you know, longer So like people that were born at the beginning of the war are now like eligible to fight in it. You know, that's 5 years longer than the Vietnam War went on. And that the kind of impact on American society that it has is profound, but one that people, I think, you know, don't think about as much as they were thinking about it during the Bush years. And so, you know, in terms of politics, I don't know. I would say there's one guy I interviewed on the podcast called Nate Bethea. He has a great podcast called A Hell of a Way to Die that explores leftism in the American military. And they have a lot more to say about, like, what that actually looks like on the ground. But, you know, I think the larger kind of turn that we've had is that, you know, those the American military service has been separated from the public in a way that makes it almost impossible to start these conversations up, because it's a portion of the American public that's smaller than it ever was before.
And so, what is the relationship between class and military organizing, both then and now?
Yeah, so I think there's like this another part of this this kind of American memory thing, this idea that we remember the Vietnam War wrong, is this idea that the people that were against the war were kind of spoiled college right. kids, like middle class kids that were all like going to Berkeley. And that's just not true. In fact, like most of the sociological studies we have show that like the further you go up the ladder of like the more money you make in the 1960s, the more likely you are to support the war. And the further you go down the economic ladder, the less money you make, the more likely you are to be against the war. And you think, well, why is that? And it's because the American working class were the ones that were fighting the war. It was their it was their sons that were being sent, and it was their sons that were being maimed, that were being asked to do the killing, and they were the ones that were dying. So, like the working class, you know, has a kind of natural connection to anti-war ideas, and has forever. I mean, if you know your Howard Zinn, you know that's where that energy comes from, and it's been like the ruling class and the middle classes that have been the most supportive of war. So, like, that part of it is important. And I think that, you know, it goes back to Nixon again. There's a really great book by Penny Lewis called Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's about kind of this idea that, like that even American labor, like the blue-collar guys, those were the guys that supported the war the most. The guys with, you know, the real Americans, you know, Sarah Palin's real Americans with, like, a yellow hard hat.
Right.
A lot of that comes out of an incident that happened right after Kent State, when four students were shot to death by the National Guard in May of 1970. Just a week later, there was a gathering of high school and college students who were holding a vigil in support of the students who had been killed. They were holding it down in near Wall Street, basically like near Zuccotti Park, and this was in 1970. And one of the major construction unions basically had a president who was very pro Nixon, very pro war. He organized some of his workers to go down and confront those students that were kind of holding this vigil, and the result was what was called the Hard Hat Riot, where like a couple 100 construction guys showed up and beat the shit out of these kids.
Right.
And beat them with like these are like high school kids, young kids. And the result was like this image that like the blue collar guys had finally stood up against these snots, against these like little brats. And Nixon, like the next day, Nixon has like a hard hat on his desk.
Oh my God, yeah.
You know, he's like totally doing the Trump thing where he's like, these are the real Americans.
Except he had the kind of self, what would you call it? He didn't put one on. Trump would have put one on. Put one on, right?
Yeah. Right. He would have put one on and like got behind the truck and done that face. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah. So Nixon very much tried to capitalize on this image. But like what Penny Lewis's book, I want to give her credit because she like really did the research to look at the unions. What she learned is that, like, I don't know, some of the bigger unions, like the UAW, they were pro-war. They were, like, for the Democratic Party. You know, the Democratic Party were, at that time, the major architects of the Vietnam War. They weren't going to go against those rulers. But the smaller trade unions, like the kind of heart and soul of the, like, I don't know, the rank-and-file working class in America, they were against the war. And there are tons of unions that, like, you know, were against the war loudly and proudly and were not just kind of against the war in terms of being, ideologically against it. They did stuff, you know, they were active against the war. So, you know, that idea that the class element of the people who are against the war affects our memory and makes us think again of like, to me, when I hear the kind of, I don't know, you see it even in the Ken Burns. I don't know if you went through 18 hours of fucking Ken Burns, but like you see,
waste of time.
Yeah, you see that image. At the end, dude, I'm dead serious. At the end of the like 18 hours of Ken Burns, the last word they give the anti-war movement is like this woman who's crying and says she's sorry for being against the war, and she wants to apologize to the American soldiers for like being so disrespectful. And it was just kind of like, that idea still matters. It's still there. And so when I hear, like, I don't know, the intellectual dark web or whatever those right-wing fuckers are out there, the Jordan Petersons, the Joe Rogans, the people who are attacking college students now and call it, you know, with this image of like spoiled SJWs,
right,
Marxist college students. I hear all of those stereotypes who are kind of like trying to force left-wing ideas and anti-war ideas into this box instead of recognizing them as what they are, which are extremely popular positions across the board, particularly across the board for like the 99% of the people who are like, you know, ordinary working class people in America. So you talk about like, you know, positions, winning political positions, be against the wars. You know, there's one of them.
It's funny because this is when class kind of was talked about, but this is almost an early class-based example of weaponizing identity politics.
Totally. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I mean, Nixon is weaponizing this kind of like identity of the blue collar worker,
right?
Even, yeah, you know, and that like this guy is like a stereotype of like this New Yorker guy that, you know, has the it goes all the way up to like the 9/11 era, right?
This macho.
It seems like it's used up by both the Democrats and the Republicans. The Republicans have this aesthetic understanding of identifying with the working class,
mm-hmm,
with like a Joe six pack, like a plumber type.
Yeah, it's always a white guy, even though like the character of the American working class is definitely like more women, more people of color. I think we can get rid of this like Joe the plumber shit, but like it's still there. Yeah, it's still definitely operative.
And then, you know, being in New York City, I'd say a lot of people who would see themselves identify as liberals or progressives or whatever will still snub their noses at the idea of working class people.
Yes.
You know, or working class people are still invisible.
Or bigots.
You know, the delivery guy is invisible. The Uber driver is invisible. All of these people are like beneath or uneducated or, you know, where... So it is. So why? So there's no class consciousness within the Democratic establishment,
right? And if there is, it's to repeat that stereotype, which I think is an important one.
Right.
Which the Trump voter is like some dumb redneck somewhere that's like really racist and stupid. And it's like, no, he's not. Like the Trump voter, like, is more likely to be someone who like owns a dealership and has a couple houses, you know?
Right?
Sells ski-doos.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It's a useful stereotype, you know, and it's one that like I think that thing of like the watching the Democratic Party turn into the party of Wall Street, and then still like you know, what relationship do they have to the working class? Because they've turned their backs on the working class. And so that part of it, I think, is really important. If they want to get back to that, they're going to have to do some of the heavy lifting, because they've helped contribute to this, I don't know, this erasure of the working class. Yeah.
And when we're talking about elections, it seems like that there's an entire class of people who haven't voted at all, since more people didn't vote than voted for either Trump or Hillary.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it too, is to understand that, you know, millions and millions of people just don't give a shit. And so why is that? And you know, that has to be on the political parties. I think that the Democratic Party and its most loudest supporters just feel like they're entitled to the vote. Yeah, just feel like, well, we're Democrats, so vote for us.
Yeah. And what's wrong? And if you don't vote for us, then you deserve to lose your health care. You're a stupid bigot, and it's not on the politicians to win your vote. It's on you to vote for them. There's such contempt. There's such open contempt from so many people who claim to be progressive.
Yeah, and I don't know what they want, you know, like because their kind of vision, they never talk about policy, you know?
Right.
They're just, I mean, I feel like a lot of that is just straight, like, kind of political bullying that exists in the media and exists to shame people
it's funny
into voting for them.
We think of like wedge issues, like cultural conservatism. We think of those as helping Republicans, which they do, right? It gets people to vote against their best interests, but it's not even that, because often the Dems aren't giving you the things that are in your best interest. But it also helps the Dems, right? Because then they don't have to talk about policy. They just make it all about the culture wars.
Yeah, and the bad guys. I mean, Trump, to me, it's like the way you talk about Trump is important, you know?
Yeah.
And like to talk about Trump as like, this guy that's gross and nasty to women and says like bad words, you know, and is like uncivil. I think that's the wrong way to go about it. They need to be attacking policy, but they have a hard time attacking policy because they're part of so many of the policies that are destructive in this country.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And I think that I guess I just saw a clip of that Anderson Cooper interview with AOC.
Yeah.
You know, where she gave I think she framed it really well when she said that Trump is like a symptom of the problem,
yeah.
not the problem. You know, and I think that messaging needs to continue and strengthen as we move forward to kind of get away from this personality politics, which is kind of been driving the whole thing for so long. You can't really get away from that. I think it's important to kind of like to recognize how the media works now. But at the same time, you know, we've got to figure out a way to get the attention off Trump's kind of personal crassness and get it towards, you know, the policies.
Well, that's funny because earlier I was saying to Gabe that AOC reminds me of kind of our Trump, but good, because she's very good at social media.
Yes.
She's very media savvy. She drives people crazy. The difference is I think a lot of people actually have a crush on her, and I don't think a lot of people at all have a crush on Trump.
But I don't even want to think about it. Yeah,
yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah, they're both very triggering of people.
Yes, yeah.
And they kind of make people lose their minds.
Well, one big difference, though, is that she's not lying with anything.
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, yeah. Right. So she's the good version. I mean, she's everything that he is, but the good version. She's not everything. You know what I mean? It's like you put him through a machine, go from evil to good, and then she comes out.
I think that the Democrats who are looking for this kind of like return to civility, where they're going to have someone come in and be like, oh, you know how they have kind of fetishized Obama. And a part of that is, you know, he speaks so well, you know, and he has this kind of like, there's that element for sure. But he's also got this kind of like charisma. He speaks to the better angels of what they think America is.
Right.
You know what I mean? So like when they hear like Walt Whitman in Obama.
Right.
And I think that's a mistake. I think that we should go. I think that the people that are using words like motherfucker and they're like saying, I think we need more of that. Like, why not? Like, we need like a crass, nasty, unapologetic left figure that doesn't give a fuck and is someone who is viral as shit. And just play that game. Who cares? Like, we're in that. Like, we're in the Black Mirror. Let's not pretend like politics is anything but entertainment. It's like there's that element of it. And the Democrats are still holding on to this notion that, like, we're all on the fucking West Wing. And that, like, Hamilton, I think, has done a disservice to all of us in the kind of, like, trying to breathe life into this notion of the, like, kind of founding fathers and all that bullshit. It's the 21st century, dude. Like, we need messaging.
Right.
And, like, Trump didn't... I mean, he's brilliant without knowing he's brilliant.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this guy's the guy's a fucking moron, but somehow he stumbled upon a template that the media loves and that resonates with people and that keeps him, like, at the top of this cycle. God, can you imagine if we had a left figure like that? I mean,
well,
I think you're right.
Yeah, I think that, like, Ocasio and Bernie are kind of the closest things to that, and that they're bold, they're unapologetic. They're very different, obviously. One is a... charismatic old Jewish guy from Brooklyn, and one is a very sassy, saucy, beautiful.
Well, neither of them fall into compromising civility, and that civility politics just makes me the definition of that is not acknowledging a rancid fart.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
exactly. And the rancid fart is a million dead Iraqis.
Right.
You know
it's not. Yeah. The rancid fart isn't just. It's not. I mean, then you have the opposite problem, which is people who identify the rancid fart, but they say it's just Trump.
Right.
And they're just using curse words against Trump, but they don't use the curse words against anything else. Like, and they think that's resistance.
Like, can you imagine a more nightmarish scenario than like Trump losing to someone like Biden and we getting and us getting like
back
like,
to normal?
Yeah, like, and everyone breathes a sigh of relief that thank God everything's fixed.
Yeah,
and it's like, how could you believe that? I mean, you have to understand that like Trump was elected in 2016 because it was a fucking crazy time. And it was a crazy time because we went through 8 years of Obama in which the politics were, I mean, they were stunning. To me, I was stunned by like how How shitty Obama was to on a lot of issues, and like healthcare was just one of them. There were a million.
I was not duped. I was distracted, honestly, by the racism. Like, and I'm not dismissing it, but I feel like I was always playing defense for Obama.
Yeah, well, the same thing happened with Bill Clinton, right? I mean, when Bill Clinton, when they were going after him for getting his dick sucked, I was like, this is ridiculous.
Republicans are fucking
disgusting. And then I'm like, well, now I'm boxed into this position of defending this guy.
Right.
When I don't want to defend him. And I think the same thing is very true of Obama. I mean, Obama was being stalked by Trump in the media during this era.
Right.
Like,
right.
And, I mean, I feared for the guy, literally.
Yeah, me too, yeah. I find Obama much more sympathetic and underdogish than Bill Clinton, even though they both grew up kind of poor. But, I mean, there's the race stuff, and there's just the various things that go into
that. I think of Obama as he's the T-1000, right? Like, he's the one that's like the liquid metal Clinton.
Yes.
The one that's like even better. I mean, he's honestly one of the most compelling and important politicians of our era.
Yeah, he really is,
I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, but like...
No, it's a dangerous thing.
Well, his message was always curb your enthusiasm.
That's really funny.
Like, Obama's entire thing was like, hold your horses.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Slow down, progress or whatever, demands. Can you tell us a little bit about turning back again about the Fort Hood 3?
Yeah. And the Fort Hood 3 are a group of three American soldiers who were all, I think, like 20, 21 years old in 1966. They were stationed at Fort Hood, which is in Killeen, Texas. Fort Hood is one of the major staging installations for the American military to send young men to Vietnam. They decided in 1966 that they weren't going. They wrote letters to the American government that said we are resisting an immoral war. And they got a lot of media attention. They had a press conference in New York City with a number of major figures from the left. They were featured in the New York Times, and they were kind of one of the major early moments of what we would call the GI movement. So the Fort Hood 3 and the Fort Jackson 8, there's ultimately going to be a Fort
Hood. Derivative,
so
derivative.
There's also going to be a Fort Hood 43. There were a lot of those like numbers groups in the 1960s and 70s.
Yeah,
but of course
they're great.
Yeah,
just it's like a band. Yeah,
the Seattle Seven. There's another one. But like the Fort Hood Three were part of part of the beginning of American soldiers not only like resisting the war and like resisting service in it, but making it's one thing to kind of just like get out of it, but they didn't just get out of it. They made a show of getting out of it. They made a statement. Ultimately, they were arrested. Their case went to the Supreme Court. It was in the courts for years.
Yeah.
Some of them served a little bit of time.
Well, all three of the Fort Hood 3 did.
Yeah, they did. And so the Fort Hood 3 would have been one of the groups that Fred Gardner, who started the coffee house movement and started the whole organization, he would have been looking at them and thinking, we need more of those.
Right.
Like, and the left needs to pay much more attention to American soldiers. Because, again, like there is this kind of stereotype that the left kind of called American soldiers baby killers,
right?
Spit on them, hated
Hanoi
them.
Jane.
Yeah, and Jane Fonda's in this story too. You asked me like, what was the most surprising thing about this book? Finding out that Jane Fonda was like a massive figure and hero to the left, but not only to the left, but the military left. That she was part of a show, like a show that she put on with a number of other celebrities, like Donald Sutherland. Who put together a show called FTA.
Together.
Yes. And this show is called FTA, Free the Army or Fuck the Army.
Oh,
which was
and
that FTA show that ultimately, toured through the coffee houses. They put on this kind of like Bob Hope style anti-war left-wing review, comedy show, songs. And the footage of it is extraordinary because what you watch is like Jane Fonda like saying all this radical shit on stage to like a group of more than 1,000 soldiers who are all cheering
in
uniform with their fists up.
Mr. President, there's a terrible demonstration going on outside.
Oh, there's always a demonstration going on outside, Pat.
Yeah, but Richard, this one is completely out of control.
Well, what are they asking for this time?
Free Angela Davis and all political prisoners, out of Vietnam now, and draft all government officials.
Central.
Well, we have people to take care of that. They'll do their job, you do your job, and I'll do my job.
Richard, you don't understand. They're storming the White House.
Oh, in that case, I better call out the Third Marines.
You can't, Richard.
Why not?
It is the Third Marines.
Oh. Down to the base, they're gonna look at my face and read out an order to bar me. So we said, Foxtrot, Tango, Alpha.
Fuck the Army!
And we're led to believe today that Jane Fonda was this person that just absolutely shat on American soldiers.
Yeah.
And if you're an American of any red blood, you're gonna like celebrate when Jane Fonda dies.
Right.
It's one of the supreme ironies and maybe the most American thing that the American government could kill millions of Vietnamese people in the 1960s. But what we remember is that a 28-year-old actress was shitty. You know
right.
what I mean? Like it was that we put that on the shoulders of like a woman and a woman
right.
who like tried to stop it. Like
right.
that to me is amazing. And it's like, you know, it makes me wonder and ask like, you know, how many Vietnamese children did Jane Fonda burn
right.
with napalm? You
exactly.
know, like all of that. And so like the Fonda story is incredible. And I guarantee that when Jane Fonda dies, whenever that happens, you know, all they will print about that is
yeah.
like how much she was hated.
Right.
And I think that, you know, if you go back.
Because she sat on a tank, is that what it was? She posed on a.
Yes.
But you're adding another level to that, because there's the irony there, but then you're actually adding another level, which is that, and she was beloved by some soldiers.
Yeah. Not only some, tons of them.
Tons,
so many of them that the American government was concerned, you know, and concerned
right.
about her. And of course, they had her, you know, tailed and followed and et cetera. They knew she was a danger.
Right.
She was and the celebrities, you know, that's another lesson for us, right? Like we're thinking about Trump.
Yeah.
Like the left needs fucking celebrities. We need figures. And
what do you mean we have Deborah Messing?
Yeah.
who tweeted that Bernie's like Judas, by the way, the other day. I'm not kidding.
She's our Angela Davis.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny because I don't think about Deborah Messing except as like, you know, a sitcom that was on a long,
long
time ago.
Yeah, Will and Grace, yeah.
Right.
But we do have, I mean, we have, all celebrities hate Trump, but you're saying that we need celebrities who actually...
Yeah, I don't mean like hashtag resistant celebrities.
Work, yeah.
And I don't necessarily mean celebrities who are famous for movies. I just mean like people who have that thing, you know, who have that
right.
kind of charisma. And I know that like Occupy Wall Street was horizontal and we're not supposed to have leaders,
right, right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Yes,
but
we're not
like...
going to reinvent the wheel either.
right.
It reminds me of the thing when you were saying personality politics. Like, yeah, it'd be great to not have those, but we do. So let's just get good people on our side
right.
and do the policy stuff too.
Right.
I mean, it's good on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She and Tulsi Gabbard and Ro Khanna were the only people to vote against that PAYGO thing.
Right, right.
That was just disgusting. I can't believe
yeah.
it. It makes
and
me
I mean,
really
but
ashamed.
Bernie Sanders has been the only voice against a lot of this shit forever. I
right.
mean, there's like a really haunting clip of Bernie Sanders like during the run up to the first Gulf War and he's like the only guy standing there. Like everyone else has like left, and it's just like one guy, Bernie Sanders, in 1990, saying that like this war is going to, you know, destroy our country, and everything he says is absolutely fucking true.
Yeah.
And nobody
yeah.
listened to him. And it's
right.
like, that's a frustrating part of it. Because for me, I hear that, you know, we've got AOC now and these others, but I'm like, we need like hundreds more.
Right.
You know what I mean? We need like, because I feel like they're always going to be these like lone radicals against all the other fucking assholes in the Democratic
right.
Party who are like, no, let's vote with the Republicans.
Right. But they change the discussion, right? Which I think then does become a politically powerful thing.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's
right.
talking about 70% right
Medicare
now, and like,
right.
yeah, and that's that to me, like, it's weird because it's clear that like the mainstream media is all like horny for AOC, and it's really gross, you know, like that
right.
dancing video and everything like that. But
yeah.
like that part of it, like capturing the attention, is part of this, like, I don't know, Trojan horsing the ideas.
Right.
Yeah, I totally, like, I want more voices like hers because I fear for her well-being. Like, being
yeah.
A celebrity like this is, it's a terrible burden to
yeah,
have
and,
every moment of your life, like, nitpicked over
yeah.
and every
yeah.
quote taken out of context. So,
although
yeah,
so far she's like Teflon.
I want more AOCs
right,
out there.
Right, right.
Yeah, she needs supporters. She,
yeah.
she, and I mean, I guess that's our job
allies,
too.
Like co-workers. Yeah,
yeah.
not
yeah.
just us, but like people in the government. Yeah,
yeah.
right. And people in the media who are actually gonna like,
right.
I don't know, get her back. You
it
know,
is
have
funny
her
though because
yeah.
yes, it's true. I mean, they vilify. It is funny because going back to that Trump thing, it's like even the people who hate her, they're so obsessed with her that they give her media, and she's so good at it.
Yeah.
That it always backfires and her tweets just like slay.
Yeah.
I can't believe I just said slay, but, and just, I just want to say something cause I want to insert stuff about this, about the Fort Hood 3. Cause I interviewed one of those Fort Hood 3 people is my uncle's late uncle's really good friend and good friend of my family's. And, I actually spoke to him a little bit about it.
Nice.
Yeah, he was one, and he went to jail for 3 years. Wow. And they were actually, yeah. There were three of them, and one was Dennis Mora, one was David Samus, and one was Jimmy Johnson?
Yes, James Johnson. Yep.
James Johnson, right. I know him as Jimmy.
And what was great about them is they were like kind of this multi-ethnic
exactly,
crew.
Black, yeah. White, and Latino.
Yep.
Actually, Dennis was half Spanish, half Puerto Rican, but that's neither here nor there. Because anyway, that was back when Spanish people were like considered non-white anyway.
Right,
but
right.
Yeah. That's a whole other discussion. And what about the... Sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, well, what I was going to say is that, you know, one element that people should know about this is that, you know, that the what was happening in the military wasn't just about the war. That, like, there was a racial thing going on in the American military that just like all the other kind of movements that emerged in the 1960s and 70s, they came out of the civil rights movement.
Right.
And they took the kind of... strategies of the civil rights movement. They took some of the language of the civil rights movement about power and freedom and things like that. So it was important that like there be this kind of like racial solidarity among people against the war, and that's what built it. Like the war built racial solidarity. So like the Fort Hood 3 are important because they signaled that blacks and whites and Latinos in men serving in the American military could actually get along and could get along around like being against the war. That was an enormously terrifying prospect for the American military, who did their best to kind of like foment racial hatred, and that's a part of the story too.
Right. Yeah. Dennis Moore was saying that even, you know, as much as he was critical of the military, obviously because he went to jail not to serve in it, but it was one of the most integrated horizontal places he had been in.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an important part of it, for sure.
Not to make this the Katie Halper family show, but where it's funny you brought up Vietnam, the first Gulf War, because we have an interview we're releasing with my mom, Nora Eisenberg, where she talks about, because of Bush's death, one of the things that really still hasn't been covered and is never covered is the first Gulf War, which, like you said, Sanders was in the minority in opposing, because even today it's still spoken about as if it's the good war.
Right. Right.
And it's really disgusting.
Yeah, and it's weird because, you know, to take that back to Vietnam is that a memory has a lot, is important, and the way we remember this stuff is wrong. And so we're kind of living in this alternate reality that's not real and not like kind of lined up with what actually happened. And I think that dissonance is a really, you know, important part of like our historical moment, because you have this like the Vietnam War was... Now, you know, everyone is against the Vietnam War. Like Ken Burns, you know, it's like, oh, well, the Vietnam War was this horrible tragedy. It was wrong, it was wrong, it was wrong, it was wrong. And it's like, well, the only people who said it was wrong during the 1960s and 70s were radicals, because liberals supported the war. They were the architects of the war. Right-wingers said that we should actually drop nuclear bombs. We should have gone even further.
Right.
The only people who were absolutely right about what happened in Vietnam were the radicals. And the people who were writing underground newspapers, who were in socialist organizations, who were fighting against the war with everything they had. And now liberals are acting like they're the ones that were against it. And like they always were. And it's like, it's just bullshit. Because, you know, to me, that was part of, just to go full circle, understanding American politics and that there was a left.
Right.
It was like learning about the history of the Vietnam War and not understanding that it was liberals that did it. And like understanding like the role that JFK played, that Lyndon Johnson played, and how they tied the like Vietnam War into the larger liberal ideas that they were connecting to the Great Society, etc. Understanding that the Vietnam War was a liberal project was a really big moment for me to understand American politics and understand that there was something further. And a critique of American politics that went beyond liberalism, and that was the left. And they're the ones that have been kind of erased from the history of the Vietnam War, but they're kind of the key part to understand it. Yeah.
And what was it that made you see that? Like that it was a liberal project?
Well, I mean, that's honestly, that's just literally kind of my early part of graduate school is going into like learning the actual history of the war. I mean, to me, it's not that hidden, but kind of understanding... I don't know. Like one of the things I saw early on that explained it to me is Daniel Ellsberg, who he was the guy that smuggled the Pentagon Papers out. And they just made that awful fucking Steven Spielberg movie, The Post, about.
Oh, yeah, I heard that was which awful.
Yeah, it was terrible. And they make the heroes to be like the Katharine Graham and like the owners of the Washington Post right. and shit. It's like really gross. Because there were people that took real risks and went to jail, and it wasn't like the rich newspaper owners who were the heroes. Right. But either way, there's a moment in the Peter Davis documentary Hearts and Minds where Daniel Ellsberg just explains how the Vietnam War and like the larger Cold War that it was a part of were like liberal projects. And that's something that everyone should know, but I didn't know that for whatever reason. And like understanding how much the Cold War was kind of put into a positive vision of America's global role in the world, you know, and like all of that, the fact that they felt that they were doing the right thing right. while they were creating the machinery to essentially commit one of the most profound genocides of the 20th century. That to me is a fascinating thing, and it makes me, you know, not trust liberals ever, and understand how deeply embedded they are in the kind of imperial project and the military industrial complex.
Yeah, well, I mean, working at Raytheon, if you're a worker there, you're just thinking about how strategic and tactical your weapons are. And minimizing body counts by just targeting that one wedding.
Yeah, exactly. And that's Robert McNamara and the kind of like WizKids and the whole liberal notion of like, it's, you still hear it with Silicon Valley, right? That we can like innovate and we can like find ways to make this concentration camp much more efficient and much more woke. And like, you know, that shit, like, I think that when I see those, I mean, you've probably seen the tweets of people clapping their hands saying like, we need more women prison guards and like that kind of shit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's important. I think that gets at a really important like kind of idea, which is that liberals kind of have used for many years the kind of cover of like, they're the good guys and they use the, and they talk right and they use the right language, which is incredibly elitist, first of all.
Yeah,
but like
totally.
They use that as cover for what they're really doing, which is like, again, they're using that bureaucratic language and that positive bureaucratic language to separate themselves from what they're really doing, which is creating that horror.
Yeah. I like to call it a rainbow capitalism.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. A diverse top 10% instead of a straight white male 1%.
Mm-hmm.
But also just this is a great way to go out, I think. Rachel Maddow tweeted the other day, all three CIA directorates will now be headed by women.
Yeah, and what does that get us?
Right? Slay queen, literally.
Yeah,
Slay queen.
I know, yeah. and that to me is just so fucking stupid. And at the same time, you know, I don't want to be the guy that's like out there.
No, I'll do it.
Yeah, you do it because it's such a trap, right?
It's such
like if
a
I'm
woman,
like,
yes,
oh,
yeah.
fuck you,
sexist.
Rachel Maddow,
yeah.
yeah, and I look like an asshole because I don't support Gina Haspel.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Who's like a fucking
how could you not recognize her? Yeah, how could you not recognize what a female? How many doors she's opened for opportunities for women to torture? People.
Yeah, right. The
How
glass ceiling. The glass ceiling goes right into a gas chamber.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, yeah. It's horrifying and it's bullshit. And anyone who has any critical faculties is able to see right through it.
Right.
But at the same time, you see how this shit is weaponized. Because
I know.
If Neera Tanden is listening to us right now, she's going to be like, oh, how convenient for you to hate women.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's like, okay.
And then she'll also lie about history and be like, don't you know it was the leftists who helped the Nazis rise to power and the liberals were trying to stop them?
Yeah. Did you know that National Socialism is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. yeah. All that stupid shit.
Alt left. Yeah.
That's really frustrating. And I mean, I don't want to be like the guy that's always like the fact checker, you know, because I don't think that's a good way for the liberals to win right now either. But yeah, it's a really frustrating part of it. Yeah.
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 If they're going to be elitist about it, we might as well be just providing the facts instead of elitist liars.
Right.
Anyway, we're elite truth tellers.
Yeah. There's one way of putting it.
Yeah. This was so great, though. Thank you so much, David, for talking to us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I never get to talk about myself and my work so much. I appreciate all the questions. Yeah,
no,
for sure.
Great. Yeah, we'll do another one, too.
I love your show, and everyone should listen to it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
Have a good night.
Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.